Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Dr. Funk Live Podcast. Thank you guys so much for tuning in on YouTube and Facebook Live and subscribing on iTunes and Stitcher and other devices. And your donations are always welcome for this stuff to keep us going. Today, we have a very special guest here. We have Robin Robinson. She's an award-winning journalist and broadcaster, and just recently hosted the 2022 Celebration of Prince at Paisley Park. We're so thankful to have her in. I hope that you guys understand what an honor it is to have Robin on, and I really appreciate her time with this stuff. Hey, Susie. Hey, Canada in the house. Australia. Much love. Even the UK, even though it's the middle of the night there. Thank you guys for joining in, and we're going to get deep into some things, and we're not going to waste any time, as I already see you guys are lining up in the rooms. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome a very, very special guest to the show, the one and only Robin Robinson.
I am so thrilled to be here. And yes, the doctor, thank you so much for asking me.
Thank you so much for being here, for real. How have you been?
I am good. It is really hot here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. But I understand, you know, this is part of what's to be expected during this season. Actually, it's about to become monsoon season, but the brush fires have been way crazy. And I give a lot of respect to the firefighters that have been struggling with this. It's probably one of the biggest firefighters in wildfires in New Mexico. So, you know, everybody watches very seriously here. Other than that, life is really good. I'm still kind of buzzing from celebration.
We're definitely getting into that. It was such a pleasure seeing you there and having you host. Now, I'm not going to go through a whole history of you because your accolades and whatnot, we'd be here forever. What made you get into broadcasting and journalism?
You know, I come from an era that, you know, it was a really heightened awareness of politics. I think it's like now. My parents were very active in Chicago politics, and they really encouraged us to know what was going on. My father was an alderman in Chicago. My mother was involved in community activism. And we sat down every night and watched the news together at dinner. One of those families that ate and watched TV. But at the end of the newscast, we were expected to talk about what was discussed. My dad also got Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, and we were expected to read those. And so I was about 12 or 13 when Watergate happened. And just knowing what, you know, Woodward and Bernstein were able to make a voice for people who were powerless and see the corruption that was going on in politics was striking to me. I came home and I didn't watch Dark Shadows and all those TV shows that kids watch at that age. I came home and watched the Watergate hearings because it was fascinating to me. It was also a time where we started to see more Black women on newscasts and not just as dancers and singers. You know, you saw Black women in authoritative roles that were giving information about what was happening in their communities. And so I was kind of raised under the impression that when you have, you give back. And you always keep your foot wedged in the door for people who don't have a voice. But then the other half of my family was all arts. I have an uncle who was a recital pianist for Agnes DeMille and George Balanchine. He was one of the first Blacks at Juilliard back in the late 40s, early 50s. And I have a sister who is a filmmaker in Hollywood. She worked for Sony and Paramount and wound up working for Mattel at the end doing video. I have a cousin in the Bay Area, Mike Baker, the bike maker, right on, who was part of the honor roll crew in Oakland. Just lots of artists in the family. So I had a left brain, right brain kind of thing where I loved art, but I had someone over my shoulder, my mother saying, that makes no money, that makes no money. So, you know, I had to think about art, but I had to have a profession too. So combining the two was only logical.
For sure. And you being attracted to that and saying that's what you want to do. Now, you got started, you go to college, you do all these things, not jumping forward. But how did you end up going to Minneapolis?
Well, it wasn't my first stop. I immediately in college and out of college worked for the CBS NBC station. And they treated me like a little mascot. You know, they were very good to me. And, you know, they helped me define who I, you know, my reporter skills, writing, presence. You know, they the photographers, I love photographers because the bottom line is their stomach. And so I would buy them McDonald's or whatever they wanted just so they would give me a few minutes in front of a camera. And so they would be out on a story near the station and they'd call me up and go, "We're on Wacker Drive for the next 20 minutes. If you want to do a stand up, get over here." You know, and then one day I heard the editors talking. They're like, "Yeah, man, edit her tape. She'll go buy you lunch." So I learned how to parlay favors to get what I needed to create a tape and then eventually get on the air. And so my first station as a reporter was in South Bend, Indiana, WNDU, Channel 16. And then after that, I had a crazy, amazing story that catapulted me to Norfolk, Virginia, where I covered military affairs. I was one of the first women to cover military affairs for that station. Did well enough that the chain took me from Virginia to Dallas, where I covered City Hall, and I had a talk show. And that was where I started getting the interest in entertainment because they let me cover it on my talk show. I interviewed people like Erykah Badu when she was a teenager, Roy Hargrove, the great jazz player who just passed a few years ago. He was 15 and I had him on camera and I was like, "So what are you going to be?" "I'm going to be the world's greatest jazz player." And I'm like, "What a precocious little kid. Can't stand him." And then I finally saw him again at the Dakota in Minneapolis. Like, "Do you remember me?" And he was like, "Oh my God." So, you know, I interviewed Raquel before it was Edie Raquel and New Bohemian. So that's where I started getting my interest in art and entertainment, but didn't get the opportunity to do it until I moved to the Twin Cities. So from Dallas, I went to Baltimore, and that's where I got my first opportunity to weekend anchor, got fired, and got hired by Minneapolis. And so that's my long tale.
It's a good one. And it seems that what you wanted to do as a child, you were able to do, where you're covering all different things, whether it's entertainment or politics or doing stuff that got you inspired through Watergate and the other things. That's a good thing. And then you land in Minneapolis, but you had to fight for it. You weren't given the lead anchor position and being the first woman of color to have that position at the station. You had to fight for that, correct?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of weird. You know, I thought that I had really proved myself. At that point, I was a reporter and I kind of created a position for myself doing urban affairs because there were reporters that were refusing to go into Minneapolis at the time because it was very heated, not unlike what happened with George Floyd. I got there in 1990 and Minneapolis police shot and killed Tysel Nelson, who was a teenager that had actually been part of like police community programs and all that, but wound up at a house party in Minneapolis that the police were called out to for noise. He ran. One of the officers, Dan May, shot him, said that he had a gun. They did not find a gun. Wow. All of a sudden, a gun was missing from police lockup that was supposedly what Tysel Nelson carried. The community didn't buy it. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, they wanted to give this officer May an award. The community was furious. And that's where I met Keith Ellison, who was still in school, going to law school, who is the current attorney general of Minnesota. But he was involved in politics early on at that point. There were rallies and protests every day. And there were very few people that the community trusted. And I fought my way into community trust. And I thought that, you know, all the things that I was doing, working in the gay community, revealing a gay serial killer, working in the African-American community with the Tysel Nelson story, working for women's groups, you know, I thought all that would easily get me the anchor slot. And no, you know, they said they were going to bring in two people from the outside and it didn't sit well with me. So I marched upstairs to the general manager's office, Stu Schwartz. And I said, "I want that job." And he said, "Well, the news director told you you know, what's going on? Why are you coming up here to my office? And I said, because you signed my check. So the bottom line stops with you. And he laughed. He goes, I can't bite you on it. And that's how I got the job. But I didn't get to sit on the set for the first half hour of the newscast. It was our newscast. I had to report from the newsroom. And then on the second half hour, I could join the male anchor on the set. I've also been asked to change seats because when you look at the screen, like right now, left, right, people read left to right. They made the left seat the male power seat. So early on, I was asked to switch seats because the power seat is the left seat. So I had a lot of different things I had to work through. But I knew that if I had the love of the community, if I could report on the community, if I could tell what was happening in the community would give back. If I knew the community names like Frogtown and Powderhorn, you know, South, I didn't want to use South Minneapolis or North Minneapolis because those were indicators of racism for people to just buzzwords. If you knew the community names, people knew that you knew them. And so that's what I did. I kept trying to enhance each community that I worked with, that I knew each community to work with. And eventually that parlayed into the buzz and arts and entertainment.
Okay. And then would you, before, and we'll get into Maite and we'll get into Prince, but before you even hung with Maite or hung with Prince, were you talking about him on air, or was it just that you knew people in his entourage or whatnot, or was it both?
Well, you know, anything that Prince did in the community, everybody reported on. I think it really didn't solidify until I did a first story about a former Prince staff member, Johan Swelos, who was one of the managers of the Glam Slams. I think he worked at the Glam Slam in LA and then wound up taking over as manager of Glam Slam Minneapolis. And I mean, it was a huge deal. And so there were live shots and all this stuff. And, you know, I wanted to get to know those folks. And so Johan and I eventually became friends. And from that, it was kind of a signal, you know, people in the music community, they're very tight. Everybody knows each other. They either grew up with each other or played with each other constantly from one band to another, cross-pollinating. And so when they saw somebody in an inner circle befriend, then it meant befriending someone else. And then I was friends with Johan for a short time. I dated Tommy Barbarella. And then The girls on staff, like Stefan Bruner, who did makeup and hair, and Sherry Hart, who did makeup and hair, became friends with me. And the circle just started to expand a little bit. And so one night, Steph called me and she says, "We're going out tonight, girls' night, Maite's coming." I was like, "Oh, this sounds like fun." So we all get picked up and we all go to South Beach, where we went through the back door. We had a table for ourselves and we were having a good time. And from there, we went to another restaurant. And then Maite makes the announcement, "I'm going to have a dance company and it's going to be all Prince music. It's going to be so cool. Will you do an interview with me?" And I was like, "Yeah." So, you know, that's a whole story in itself, but it wound up happening. Prince liked it. And then he was like, "You want to do an interview with me?" So that's really how it all happened. It happened pretty organically, but with some news kind of tied in there too.
Right. And of course, dating Tommy Barbarella, I'm sure there's a few girls in this room right now or other people that are going to watch it later. They're a little bit jealous of you.
Tommy is a genius and he's very shy sometimes. And, you know, just he's a total Scorpio. You know, you can't get around a Scorpio. They have tons of personality. So, yeah, Tommy's a great guy.
For sure. And with the interview with Maite, and about the dance company, and we saw the footage, and it's unfortunate, like before it got to LA and other places, it was canceled, but it's so interesting to see how many projects he would come up with and there would be money put behind it and wouldn't come to fruition. But at least we're able to see some of the footage on your show. What did he think of the interview with her that you did? Because that was like kind of like her first interview by herself without the band, without him. And you got that.
Well, okay. So it started like this, you know, we set it up. We had it all planned. We get out to Paisley Park. We set up our cameras and no Maite. She's on stage with her dancers dancing and choreographing. And so they said, okay, well, she'll be with you in a little bit. And a little bit turned into a half hour, 45 minutes, an hour. Right. You know, I got a photographer who's looking at me cockeyed going, we got to get back to the station because it takes, you know, so many, an hour to even do it, about a minute or two of editing. And so I'm starting to get a little uptight. Photographer's a little uptight. I got to make this happen. So I asked Jackie Thompson, I said, Jackie, can I talk to Maite for just like 5 minutes? And so she comes off stage and I said, this isn't one of those down and dirty interviews when I want to know what's going on in your bedroom. Okay. You know, and her eyes got big. I didn't have any sense. No one told me I couldn't say these things to people who of celebrity stature. I've said some stupid things to people throughout my career, but for some reason it made them kind of perk up. And so I told her, I said, this isn't about that. This is about you without him. This is your moment. And she just thought about him and she's like, let's go. What I didn't know, Jeremiah, is that up on those catwalks in the studio, Prince was standing up there listening the whole time.
I'm sure.
Yeah. So I had the talk show, Talk with Robin. This was like the first episode ever. And we're editing, and then Paisley Park calls and said, we want to see it before it hits air. And I just knew how Prince was. If he did not like one word, it's not going to go on the air.
Right.
And I didn't want to face any lawsuits either, because he is litigious. So I said, you know, we sent that tape out. I don't know what happened to it. We sent the courier. It must have gotten lost. You know, it just must be a busy day. I'll call and check on that, and I'll get back to you. There was no way I was going to let them have that tape before it hit the air. They must have called three times, and three times I told them, you know what? I'm really sorry. I can't tell you. We're going to have to hire a new courier, definitely. It hit the air. I was happy, and then the phone rang at the assignment desk, and there was somebody at the assignment editor goes, Robin, it's Jimmy Jam. Okay. I get on the phone. I was waiting for Prince and Jimmy Jam. He's like, Robin, I would like for you to do something with my wife. And I was like, it's not about the wives. It's my day, you know? So I agreed I would do something with the two of them, you know, of course. But then right after that, the phone rang and it was somebody at Paisley Park that says, he'd like for you to come out this evening. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I've burned a bridge. I'm going to get cursed out. This is not good. So I go out there after work and I heard this little tick, 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 tick. And then a bunch of little tick, 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 tick. It was Maite running down the hallway in high heels and all the little dogs. And she's like, I love it. I love it. I'm going to send a copy to my mom and dad. I'm going to send a copy to my friends in Germany. So I'm feeling a little bit of relief. But then I heard a slower tick, 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 tick. And it was dude. And he just kind of walked up and then he stuck his hand out and he just kind of looked at me and he was like, you were fair to my wife. And I said, I have no reason to screw over you or her, dude. You know? Right. And so he goes, want to do an interview with me? And I tried to be cool. Like, yeah, I could do that. Sure. And so the fact is, I know some of the folks online that were responding to some of the things you said thought that that interview happened at Northrop. The interview happened in Fargo. Mm-hmm. He made us drive to Fargo in a snowstorm to get that interview. And we did. So somebody said something about that was an ugly couch. We were sitting in a Fargo Dome dressing room, which aren't particularly pretty. And I think I'm going to tell you a little bit more of the backstory, because we get there and everybody's like, you can't come in here. And we're like, Prince told us to come. And they went back to the stage and they came back. Oh, okay. Well, we'll put you in a dressing room. We opened the dressing room. And just as we walked through the door, Takumi Prince's stage manager that handles guitars, hadn't had a chance to like clean up or do anything. So he was using Prince's shower and he steps out the shower just as I walk in the room. Sorry, Takumi. But yeah, that's how the interview process started. And then we get set up after that kind of shock. And then Prince came off stage and did about 2 hours with us. And then he invited Larry to join us, Larry Graham. And we did an interview with Larry. And then we shot those promos that everybody saw online on YouTube.
Right. Now, when he talked about judging of music, and then he goes, you know, some people will say like this couch is an ugly couch. It's a couch. Is that where it came from, him saying that? Because someone said in his presence or whatnot, this couch is ugly. That's where we're going to be doing the interview. But that's all they had in Fargo, right?
That's all they had in Fargo. We tried to make that room look nice, but there was no way we could make it look nice. It just looked like a really empty, bad dressing room.
Right. He seemed very comfortable talking to you in the conversation, albeit he had the sunglasses on, but that's a little bit to protect himself. I did love how one of your first questions, at least that's the question that we first see, is that you haven't played a large arena in Minneapolis in about 10 years. Why is that? And he deflected to band members and I was saying like they don't really like playing there when we know it was probably him when he's talking about music critics. And of course, at that time, him and John Bream had a
fall. Yeah.
So I'm sure that played into it, but I like that he answered the question, although deflected, and instead of saying it was him that had the issues, that it was them, kind of using them as scapegoats. But like Minneapolis and of the world, kind of like, especially it was during the name change. And if people have just been following him maybe in the past 10 years or since his passing, he was seen as the strange one because of the name change and how he was treated. But I'm sure it was even harder in his hometown because he never really did leave Minneapolis. He may have went to LA, but he always had Paisley Park in Minneapolis. So I'm sure those things affected him more so, correct?
I think that he really cared about the community more than he cared about the critics, but he was sensitive of what the critics were saying. I mean, you have to remember at the time it was a confluence of things. It was him having issues with Warner Brothers and hence the symbol name. Then it was he and Maite and their child. And it was CJ, the gossip columnist. And it was John Bream. You know, he had a very good relationship with Jim Walsh. But he did have issues with media at the time. And he needed people he could trust. And because of the background, there was also the fact that I think right after the interview. Yeah, it was after the interviews. I always tried to be as honest with him as possible, you know, and I think the fact that he saw that I handled the question about their parenthood as gracefully as I could, that would give Maite the opportunity to say, well, of course I want a family, I want babies, you know, but not hammer on the fact that they lost a child due to, you know, defects. It was a really stressful, horrible thing for any couple to have to go through. And the station was insisting at the point that I give some answers because the gossip columnist had gone on Oprah and other shows to talk about Prince. And she was unrelentless and really persecuting them, showing up at Paisley Park unannounced, trying to catch him as he came out or into Paisley Park. You know, today I think pretty much people would consider it stalking. And you know, he was unhappy with that. And so that's why I started that way, because it was an opportunity for him to rebut and critique. You know, that was important for me, to give him his opportunity to have his say back.
Right. And it just seems that he always had love for Minneapolis and was giving to the community without them even knowing. And then we see now he finally has a large mural, and there was other smaller murals here in Los Angeles and in Minneapolis behind the Chanhassen Theater.
Yeah.
Bob Dylan was first. How do you think he felt about that?
He wasn't pleased. I mean, you know, Bob Dylan left Minnesota. Only because he had a brother that was still in the Twin Cities that he actually gave back. He bought the Orpheum Theater and kept it from going under and held on to it for a few years before the two brothers sold it. Like you said, Prince never left. He was always there. And what people didn't know is that he's amazingly philanthropic. Amazingly philanthropic, and they asked people not to discuss it. So when you have somebody who stays in the community, goes and hears other bands on a regular basis, invites people out to his home and studios to test out music, because basically that's what Brother Jules did for him, is test new music. You know, somebody who loved the community so much that he wasn't too proud to get on a bike and go riding around and, you know, go buy mac and cheese at Lund's grocery store. And, you know, he was just visible and present and gave back to his community. He made it possible, truly, for years, for Black bands to be in downtown Minneapolis, because there was a segregated code against Black bands in the 70s and early 80s. If it wasn't for him doing that, you know, he would have never opened up the entertainment scene. I'm still trying to find out from convention and tourism how much money Prince brought into the community during the 90s with Glam Slam, how much money that he fed the infrastructure of the state. Because Minneapolis has a huge arts presence, bigger than most states around the country, bigger than California. Minnesota brings in $3.8 billion in revenue in arts, which is larger than California, which is $3.4 billion in arts revenue. A large part of that was Prince, because there were people just like myself that sat in a movie theater and saw Purple Rain and said, I'm going there. You know, but they added on, I'm going there and playing with him, recording with him, producing for him, dancing for him. You know, it was a beacon to people to come there. And that's what fed the infrastructure. For him not to get that recognition was insulting. And I think when people first heard that mural was going up, those who know went, ooh, you're going to be mad. And I've heard through the grapevine, he was a bit hurt. He was a bit hurt. So yeah, even when I did that story, did the first interview, he hadn't done an interview in 10 years. We were the first station in Minnesota he ever gave an interview to. And the newsroom was excited. Everybody was thrilled. General manager calls me upstairs. Well, it's not Dylan. And I sat there for a minute and I blinked and I just went, okay. And I just got up and went back to my desk. He was one of the greatest sons of Minnesota. And he brought the world there. If that doesn't deserve commendation after commendation after commendation, I don't know what does. But, right after he died, I worked with a consortium of folks that included regents from the University of Minnesota. We really wanted to give him an honorary degree. And he had agreed to it, but then he passed. And afterwards, we worked behind the scenes so hard to try to get that recognition for him. But if it didn't pass. And I have to give props to Sharon Smithock and Sonia for working 7 years and without fail to make it happen, that mural happen.
Right.
I'm really pleased that she asked me and my company to come in on that.
Thank you for that. And it seems, you know, you weren't getting the respect that you deserved when you were working at the station, and Prince wasn't getting the respect that he deserved from Minnesota from it, but he was giving you the respect that you deserved, correct?
Yeah, I'm so honored by that. I have to admit, the girl fan in me was like, how come I didn't get in a video? But, you know, I know that the people at Paisley Park would tell me often, he respects you, Robin. And that means more to me than anything. And I think he really felt over time that he could really trust me. The biggest reward I could ever get is that he asked me to sit with his mother, you know, during his parties for the year 2000, Raven to the year 2000. That's the biggest compliment you can get from anybody, that he asked me to come sit with his mother so she wouldn't be sitting in the bleachers alone. So, yeah, you know, I'd like to think that I was more than just a news conduit. I can't say that we were close friends, but I'd like to think that we were friendly and good associates, and I could help him when I could.
And during that time between Emancipation, New Power Soul, Crystal Ball, you were at the Essence Awards, correct? They flew you out.
Yes, that was so crazy. Yeah, you know, I can't even believe that. I think that took a lot of zhuzhing by Jackie Thompson, but he said, yeah. And I think I messed up again. I messed up the first time when I think he asked me out on a date. But the second time I messed up, he had some folks from Paisley Park come and meet me at a restaurant in Minneapolis. And they were talking about the trip to New York, the Essence Awards. And then they started talking about PR. And I think that he wanted me to come and work for him, but I just pretty much kind of said, oh, no, I need more money. And I was like, oh, my God, what's wrong with you? But anyway, yeah, the long and short of it is that he took me with him to the Essence Awards. And I don't think the hotel's there anymore. He got suites for everybody at the Royal Riga. I had never had a suite that big in my life. But it was lovely. The reason he asked me to go is because they called from Paisley Park and asked me, would I write the intro for him to get the award at the Essence Awards? And so I was thrilled, and I called Sharon Smith at Akinsanya, and I was like, what should I say? La, la, la. So I wrote it, and they called, and they said, he wants to say thank you, but he's going to go with Chris Rock's intro. I was like, oh, Chris Rock, of course, I can't be Chris Rock. Go ahead, you know, that's cool. But their thank you was to take me with them to New York in the Essence Awards. And that was really an amazing experience. You know, I think I sat behind Malak, Compton Rock, and Susan Taylor, who was the editor of Essence. I was about three rows back. I couldn't sit in the front, you know, but I was about three rows back. And Prince got up, made a speech, and then they played. It was him and Larry and Chaka Khan. And then after that, they all went to Irving Plaza, where he performed. And I got to sit next to Donatella Versace, who was very cool. You know, she was just like, oh, this is great, right? And I'm like, yes, this is great, right? Yeah, you know, it's like, what do you say? Donatella's talking to you, you know? I think Billy Corgan from Smashing Pumpkins was standing like right by. It was star-studded evening. It felt like magic. It was a wonderful experience, truly wonderful experience. Chaka Khan, Larry Graham, you know, and the whole crew who I truly loved, you know, and going back to Celebration was like old home week, man. It was just wonderful to see everybody.
Right. And I want to get into more personal times with Prince, but let's go through the Celebration.
Yeah.
How that came to be, and how was it being back inside Paisley Park for you?
It came to be because I was asked by a big PR head in the Twin Cities. She did Super Bowl 52 and all that. She asked me, she goes, Robin, are you available? And I was like, yeah. When I got to Paisley Park, President Nelson was so sweet. He was like, we wanted you here. And it had been years, really, since I had been out to Paisley Park. There was that transition between Maite and Manny, Manuela, that I really didn't see Prince after he got married to Manuela. I mean, it was kind of ships passing in the night. If something was important to him, he'd call. But I didn't go out to Paisley Park that much. So I'd say the last couple of years before he died, I didn't see him. I talked to him, but I didn't see him. And then when he passed, so much happened between the various bands, the university, folks that were connected, you know, to administration, that everybody wanted to do something, but there are different priorities to people and different issues. And I was really kind of disappointed that things come together smoother. And I just removed myself. It was too much emotionally to kind of deal with his passing. I found out before everybody else found out. And that's what made it really hard, because I was headed to work at like 8:30 in the morning, and I got an email from a very close friend who was very deep inside Paisley Park and said, something bad has happened. And I looked at it and I didn't even want to think that way. I just kind of was like, well, let me know when you know what's up. And then it came back again. It was somebody in Paisley Park. And I was like, that could be anybody. So really don't go on that line. But they knew. And so finally, the TV stations, you know, Channel 9 started calling me and asking me, Robin, what's going on? And I was like, you know, I really don't want to say just yet. And then finally it was confirmed. It made it hard, basically, because I didn't want to go to work. I didn't want to do anything, you know. I wanted to be like everybody else and just grieve. But at that point, I was art director of the airport. Airport is 24/7. It never stops. I had to go to work. And people, you know, they knew that I was close to Prince, but there were some people who didn't, and they wanted to play music and just talk about, and I just didn't want to do any of that. You know, it was too much emotion in it. And so I just kind of shut down and just kind of X'd myself off. Going back for celebration renewed my heart and my focus on what I wanted to do. I didn't get to talk to Prince before he died, but what I wanted to do was preserve his legacy for him. I wanted to be a part of preserving his legacy. And so I saw celebration as the opportunity to be part of that again, to really talk about the future and what we can do to make sure that the annals of history know this is one of the brightest stars in the celestosphere. You know, this was a genius in our midst that we could touch, that will be written about forever. And it's our obligation to make sure that happens. All of us, fans, you, me, the bands. This is a genius in our lifetime. Most people don't get to touch greatness like that. So,
for sure. I just felt there not being a celebration for a few years, and then it actually now being in June instead of April when he passed, which it's tougher for me. And I'm sure it's tougher for others. I was there the weekend before he passed away at Paisley. We didn't talk. I didn't think he wanted to talk. But it's like, it's so heavy. And for it to be in June and have someone like you there, it just felt very celebratory, for sure. And for the first time since his passing, being able to be there, although the Welcome to America party last year and a few other things, but it just felt, there was a lot of joy.
There was. You know, there was a lot of love in that building. Mm-hmm. It was palpable that the fans were just so glad to be there. And I think Mitch and all the guys at the staff at Paisley Park and Prez, they know the beauty and the delicacy of this relationship with the fans, the super fans that were there. And they treated them with great respect, I think, and great care, knowing that these are people who are really the forever faithful. And they were happy to see them and happy to be back. And they really planned an excellent program for everybody. And my highlights, I think, I loved the beautiful collection, the shoe. That was so well thought out.
Right.
Man, that was just so interesting, so fascinating. And so Maya, do you remember when Jill was talking about her relationship with Prince and the lights flickered?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, and I don't think they noticed it. I don't think Andrea or Jill noticed it because it was from behind them or whatnot, but it was kind of like around the time where she said a little bit of something about him. And then she's like, during Graffiti Bridge, he was like looking kind of good. I may have to take him back. And then
flick.
It was like, oh, really now, huh?
I was like, oh, dude was definitely like, Jill, giving her the side eye. Let everybody knew he was there. And you could feel him there. You really could.
It's so weird. That's why I keep telling people, like, oh, there's no reason to come back. I'm like, he's still there. I feel it. at times. Maybe not this much this time, but there's been times, I said it before, where I'll feel a little something. I'm a tall person. I'll feel a little something, and there is no one around me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, someone just touched me. I felt that in 2017 and again in 2019. There's just something there. But yeah, the flickering of lights. Sometimes the microphone's not working. It's like, saying some stuff that he wouldn't be saying if he was here, right?
Cut the mic. Click.
Get off the stage.
Exactly.
Now, you had like some personal time with Prince. You talked about where you thought you didn't realize it was a date.
Yeah.
Not. Do you care to share anything about that or whatnot?
Yeah, it's funny, I think, because, you know, I was still relatively new reporter in the Twin Cities. I think I'd been there a year or two, maybe more than that, maybe about three or four. Okay, so I said, we're not fans, we're family. Yes, I have said that forever family. Definitely. I believe that. Don't get me wrong. Love you. But honestly, I got a call from Paisley Park and they said, Prince wants you to come out tonight. It was a Friday night. I'm thinking, you know, he's got a news story or something that he wants me to cover. Yeah, I'm gonna go out there. I mean, I'm strictly all about the news, right? I'm not thinking anything else, but it's a news story and I got to get out there.
Right.
And I get out there and somebody came downstairs and said, Prince wants you to go upstairs to this room. And I was like, okay. And I go upstairs, he's there. He's friendly, but he's quiet, you know? And he goes, do you like Midnight Special? I was like, yeah, I like Midnight Special. I didn't think much about it. Yeah, I dig it. And he reaches over, he pulls out a VHS tape, sticks it in the machine. And I'm thinking he wants me to kind of look at this because of a news story angle or something, you know? So we're watching it. And all of a sudden we started getting comfortable. We're sitting on the floor. And then we went from sitting on the floor to laying on the floor like this, watching TV. And he gets up and he goes, are you hungry? And I said, no. Yeah, because I'm not thinking anything more than I'm out here to do news and la la, you know. And so I'm just like, no, I'm not hungry, no. But time went by and it's like 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'm like, well, I gotta go. It's kind of late. And you know, I didn't really think, I just knew it was late. I need to go home. And I had never been out to Paisley Park before. So I was like, how do I get back to the Twin Cities? And so he walked me outside and it was very weird to have Prince. When I think about it now, giving me directions through Twin Cities, you have to get on Highway 101 and then you take 5 and then that'll take you back into the city. You know, and it was really, it was very sweet. And he hugged me and we said goodnight. Didn't think about it for years. And then Dave Chappelle did the Charlie Murphy's True Hollywood Stories. And when it got to the part where they said, okay, he beat you in basketball. Now what? And he said, he served us pancakes. It clicked. And I was like, oh my God, I think that was a date. And prior to that, I had an art gallery and Prince kind of stopped in real quick once and he kind of rode me. He's like, where's the African-American artists? And I was like, well, I don't have one up right now. You should have African-American artists. So I wanted to show him that I had African-American artists. So I took one of my prize artists who just won a Guggenheim award out to Paisley Park and wanted to gift it to Prince. And when I got there, there was this beautiful black woman. I mean, she was like gorgeous Hershey chocolate bar color, short cropped afro. I've since seen her in pictures that Randy St. Nichols has taken. So I'm not sure she was a dancer or what at that time, but she was in the kitchen just sitting there and looking gorgeous. She was tall and long and beautiful and just, you know how you see people who, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, she makes me feel insecure as a woman. She was just gorgeous and fast, just this incredible woman. And then Prince walks in and he starts making her food. And he's like, are you hungry? I had heard that before and I was like, no, it's okay. I just want to drop this artwork off. I knew I shouldn't have been there because I looked like I was imposing on something. And then the True Hollywood Stories thing came out, and I was like, that was a date. Oh my God, that was a date. And I didn't even know it. How stupid am I?
You were not expecting it. You were being professional.
I was being professional, but I'm still jealous of Lauren Green. That wound up, I'm like, how come I didn't get asked to be in a video? I wanted to be in a video too. You know, I had to fight those urges of fan versus professionalism a lot.
Right. But you got more one-on-one time with them. And now because of YouTube and these other things, those things live on. Albeit it may not be the My Name is Prince video. And, you know, him giving you directions, this is before Google Maps, before MapQuest, you had like had to do this stuff and experiences. Now, the Midnight Special, was it the episode that he was on or was it just a random episode?
It was of Larry Graham performing.
Okay. Curious.
So he was formulating those ideas in his mind already about him, Larry, and Shaka at that time. Mm-hmm. This was just before Emancipation came out. Mm-hmm. And then around Emancipation, that's when Tommy and I started going out.
Interesting. You're making a few people jealous in here. Gotcha. Chill out there, Day Tommy. I think it's very important that you bring up being at the art gallery and him mentioning that there's no African-American artists, because it seems that people are trying to say, oh, they're going with this narrative now about that he was always for Black arts and this other stuff. There's so much history that proves that isn't true, that he was always about it. It just wasn't being reported on or being discussed. So I appreciate you sharing stuff like that because, you know, not everyone knows everything. Sometimes it's a boring era and we have to let them know that he was always about it and representation was super important to him.
I think the George Michael song, Freedom, explains it very well. You know, you shake your ass, and that's all people want. People started to pigeonhole Prince as this assless chaps dude. Mm-hmm. You know, that he wasn't to be taken seriously because of what he wore, the message that he was, you know, sending out at the time, which was really more diverse and inclusive than many, many other performers at that time. And when you think about the videos at that time, it had a great deal of representation in the community. But people weren't seeing it. They were still kind of like, oh, he's weird. He wrote slave on his face. Oh, he's weird. He has a symbol for a name. And they use that. I think people use things against people when they are afraid of the new or something that's changing. Mm-hmm. And they try to demean it. And I think that was everybody's mistake because Prince has always been 10 years ahead of everybody, you know, and he was philanthropic in the community on issues that people did not even start to really realize how important they were. I think he would have done a great deal more if he hadn't passed away. I mean, you know, he was working with Hayes and Rosario Dawson to create affordable housing in Baltimore. He took care of the charter prep schools in the Twin Cities, like Harvest Prep. When the only Black radio station at the time lost their transmitter because they couldn't afford their bills, Prince bought a transmitter. The only caveat was it had to face Jan Hassan so he could hear it. So he did everything for people and then told people don't talk about it. And I just think that people need to know that he was always about the community, always about his people, always about issues that were really important, social justice, education, environment. And people it was a period where people just didn't want to take him seriously. He knew more about the internet than most people know about the internet now. You know, and people laughed at him for trying to go off on his own and control his own music. But then they give all the credit to Pearl Jam and bands like that. He was before Pearl Jam doing this stuff.
Right.
So, you know, I just think sometimes being an avant-garde African-American man in the entertainment industry, they tried to pigeonhole him and dismiss him. And they will be forgotten. He won't.
Right. It's easy to call someone weird. It's easy to call someone crazy and say these things instead of looking deeper into the message. Now, I want to get back to the 98 interview, but I want to jump forward to the 2000 interview before he did the Northrop show for the first celebration, because he was ever evolving. And that's something that I think more of us need to strive on, is understanding how we were 3 years ago isn't indicative of what we are now. He looked like a totally different person. The sunglasses were gone, longer hair, seemed to be more freedom when doing the interview in the music club room with you. You could see the difference in that, of course, and you're seeing it. How was that interview compared to the 98 interview?
That interview was more fun, more Prince relaxed. He didn't have a message he was trying to get out. He just talked about the direction he was going in his music and things that he was developing. I think at that point he was even in his mind developing Third Eye Girl. And I just think it was more relaxed. It was more complicated getting it set up that he was making me crazy that day. And that was, again, when I started saying stuff that you don't say to artists caliber. But that's the day that he kept making us move from room to room and kept talking about those frizzy lights. Oh, my gosh. I thought I was going to lose my mind. I was at a station, an independent station that didn't have a network backing it at the time. We didn't have a lot of fancy equipment like the other stations. You know, we did a lot of things kind of like Mickey Rooney movies. You know, my father has a barn and you got some lights and let's put on a show. You know, a lot of times people don't know what happens behind the scenes in TV. And we had a very small station with not a lot of the bells and whistles. And so, you know, we're coming out there to give him a great interview. And he just keeps going, Herb Ritz has frizzy lights. If you have frizzy lights, it makes the interview look really good. You know, Herb does frizzy. And at that point, I got a photographer who's pissed off. We got to get back to the station. I just turned around and was like, look, dude, I don't have any GD frizzy lights. Okay? But we're going to make you look good. We're going to make you look good. And he got quiet. And at that point, he realized, you know, we got to sit down and do this interview. But then during the interview, it got really playful. And I finally just told him, I said, you know, I wore lingerie to one of your concerts. And he just fell out. And he was like, and he started laughing. He was like, I was like, why are you embarrassed? You told us to do that. You said do it. Come on now. I did it. He's, you're going to lose your job. I said, I'm not going to lose my job. I'm not going to lose my job. I said, you know, I also wrote you a letter. He goes, you did. I said, what did it say? I said, well, it was pasted together. And it said things that I don't think I can repeat on the air. Oh, you're going to lose your job. I said, I'm not going to lose my job. I'm not going to lose it. So I can't even tell you all the things we talked about in that interview. All I remember is that, that was the Wah Pedal interview too, where he was talking and I just kind of started losing track of all the things he was talking about because I was angry that he made me walk from room to room and I got other things in my head. And so finally he was talking and he was swinging his foot and it just came out. And I was just like, what size shoe do you wear? And he just looked at me and then he stood up and he goes, come here. He grabbed me by the hand. He walked me up to the riser on the stage. And all the equipment was out on the stage. And he goes, put your foot on the wah pedal. So I did. My foot's about an eight and a half. Right. And he goes, see, it doesn't fit. Doesn't fit. Because I'm going to put my foot on the wah pedal. Put his foot on the wah pedal. I think he wore about five. And he goes, see, it fits. It fits. You know why it fits? You know why it fits? It's ordained by God. Ordained by. Okay, dude. All right, come on. Let's do this interview. Yeah. At that point, you can't argue with someone like that. So, okay, it is ordained by God. We know this. All right. Let's do this interview. So it was a playful interview. It went all over the place, and I loved it. It wasn't so serious.
Now, looking back on the 98 interview, a question that you asked, not trying to get somber here because we already did it, but you brought up about in 20 years, you're going to be 60. Can you still see yourself performing, jumping off pianos? And, you know, it's now it's hard breaking to watch a little bit to where I was like, God willing, he will be. And grandpa will like still be whooping that ass.
It gives you chills when you go back and you see how time becomes prophecy. And it gave me a chill and it made me sad at the same time. You know, it was just a random question. You know, you gonna be making music at 60, you know, thinking about bands like the Rolling Stones and things like that, you know, it's an obvious question. You know, he had tons of music in his head. There's the vault, you know, you gonna still be performing? And he's like, willing? Yeah, you know, yeah, call me grandpa. Grandpa's still gonna whip that ass. And we just laughed. I mean, it was,
excuse me.
It's sad. It's bittersweet, you know?
Right.
But I think, you know, he said something to me once at the Roxy in LA. I had just shown up that night. My sister lived in LA at the time. And he was playing the Hollywood Bowl. And I walked over to the table and they let me sit down. And he said, did you catch the show? And I was like, no, my sister lives in LA. Again, no filter. And I was like, was it a good show? And he just got kind of somber and he goes, you know, when I'm on stage, it's always good. I think here's a person that had a lot of sadness in his life sometimes, his personal life. And it's hard when all those things converge, you know, and you're looking for answers. And a lot of times you look for answers in the people around you and you are in emotional hurt and in physical hurt. And I think those things converged, but I think it was an accident that he left us. It was just a horrible accident. And I think he was trying to take care of some physical pains and it got out of control and he was trying to get the help that he needed, but it all converged too late. But I think if that hadn't happened, he'd still be here making music.
For sure. On a lighter subject, because, you know, he stayed in contact with you through his life. And then in 2010, early in 2010, when the Vikings were doing quite well and were one game away from the NFC Championship game, he hits you up to say, hey, I got a new song, Purple and Gold, I want you to drop.
Much shit for that. I have people that still don't let me live that one down. You know, I was excited. Yeah. You know, I'm thinking it was something that was going to be dropped on the one. Dude, it's going to be live. You know, it's going to be sparks. It's going to be electric. I'm so psyched. I'm like, yeah, we got a funky Super Bowl. This is going to be amazing. You know, I'm like freaking out. I can't wait to release it. I'm going to be the one to release this. Oh my God, it's going to be a hit. Everybody's going to be playing it all over the world. Okay. Well, I'm not going to say it was bad. It was exactly what an old traditional fight song would be. And that's what I'm going with. It was a fight song, a traditional fight song. It wasn't a funky downbeat, on the one, put your foot in it. Yeah, it wasn't one of those. But, right. You know, it was still kind of a kick. I just caught so much crap from people about that one.
Yeah, we had no idea. Like, I saw that he was giving it to you. I posted it on my site. We're giving the links to watch the live broadcast. And then,
yes, I remember.
The response was, yeah, I mean, people were like, what was that? And again, we're expecting it, that funk, the drums,
yep,
all this stuff, and then you got a fight song.
Yeah.
And people are like, what was that?
What was that? I mean, I didn't live that one down for a couple of years. People were just like, yeah, Robin, like the fight song. I was like, I didn't get a sample of it. I didn't know what it was going to be. I was listening to right along with everybody else. So, yeah, that... You know, things don't always happen the way we want them to happen. You know, yeah. You've got to give artists their room to create and do what they want. And that's what he did. He gave us a fight song in the old traditional sense of a fight song.
Right. And then sometimes he would give myself rehearsals and then sometimes give the current cause and effect or hot summer.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. You know, I was hoping that, you know, we have something. Well, I'm not going to say it wasn't fantastic. It was what it was, you know.
Now, after being an Emmy Award winning broadcaster or whatnot, like you talked about this before, I'm going to touch base before we wrap things up or whatnot, but you had to pay for your own set or have your own furniture, and you even had to pay more fees for doing your theme song for The Buzz.
Okay. So, you know, I'm thinking the Channel 9 is going to treat me like they treat a lot of their anchors. They give them a new set, you know, they build something new, la, la, la. I'm excited. They're giving me a talk show, you know, very excited that they're giving me a talk show. And so I go to them and I was like, I've got an idea for the set design that I want. And they're like, no set design. Sorry, we're not giving you a new set. Wow. And I was like, what? You know? And, you know, again, as an African-American woman, I know that oftentimes when I'm put into a situation, I can't just give 100%. I have to give 150%, you know, because what's going to be said is, well, we gave her an opportunity and it failed. And I didn't want to have that happen. I wanted a beautiful set. You're giving me a talk show. I deserve to have a beautiful set. And I decided to pack up all the furniture in my living room. I got the guy who was in charge of the kids show, because they had a van, to come to my house and load it into the truck and take it out to Eden Prairie, where our studios were, and put my set up there. And I asked them too, I said, are you going to pay for or license music for a show bed? A theme song, because that's what most stations do. They buy the music and they, you know, use it for whatever they have in mind. And so because Channel 9 was buying music for different things, I assumed that they were going to buy music for me, and they said no. And it just, all it did was make me more committed to making a perfect talk show. So I called Morris. Morris was dating a friend of mine at the time, Mandy Fallon. Mwah. And he was in the studio, and the studio was not too far from my house. And so we'd often go over there, and he'd be with Jack Robinson, his partner, another heaven-sent person. And I told him, I said, can you believe the station is not going to give me theme music for my talk show? And he goes, I said, would you produce something? Because I knew he and Jack were producing for a lot of people in the Twin Cities. And he said, yeah. I never even asked him what he was going to. He just did it, and he gave it to me. And then Channel 9 said they weren't going to pay for it. So I came out my pocket for it.
Wow.
And I designed the graphics for it. And I produced it myself. And I wrote the script for it, and I hosted it, and it won an Emmy.
Congratulations on that, and literally doing it all yourself without their support.
Well, after it got the Emmy, I started getting things.
Of course. Of course. And so, you were probably like, oh, yeah. All right, mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to get the extra of this. Maybe $10 more, but yeah, you're getting it for me now.
Pretty much. You know, I always try to remember that people have lower expectations of you than you have of yourself. So you have to really show people what you can do sometimes. I mean, I've had people with my jewelry line, one of the top real estate people in the state, who is also a massive art collector who's known internationally, Ralph Burnett, gave me an opportunity to do a fashion show at his new hotel. Mm-hmm. And we put it together. We had media there, all kinds of folks. His manager comes over and looks at me and she goes, you know, I really didn't think you could pull this off, but this was fantastic. And it took me back and I was like, wow, you didn't think I was capable. So I always try to keep that in mind, that people always have lower expectations of you than you have of yourself. And that goes for everybody. You know, if you believe that you can do something and you focus on it, you can do it. I, you know, from the start of my career, even when I was in high school and college, I knew I was going to be a reporter. I just had it in my mind. I fixed it in my mind. I was going to be a reporter. From the moment I sat in that theater in South Bend, Indiana, and I watched the montage of Let's Go Crazy at the beginning of Purple Rain, I said, I'm going there. And things just kind of fell into place. Yes, I did wind up dating a Minnesotan in Baltimore. And I didn't know that he was from Minnesota. I just started dating this guy. I met him at Johns Hopkins. And he goes, it's too bad we just started dating because I'm moving back home. I said, where's home? He said, Minnesota. I was like, oh. And then not long after that, I was reading the Baltimore newspaper and it said, big article, World Battle of the Bands winner, ipso facto, which was a big band in Minneapolis at the time. And it said to me, this is ordained. I'm supposed to be there. And when Michael moved back to Minnesota, I followed him. And he hated it. He moved back to the East Coast. I stayed. And that's that story.
Awesome. Now, what are you doing now? And just curious what you're up to. And maybe we can throw some business your way.
Oh, I'd love that. I'll make it really quick. I left Channel 9. I ran for Lieutenant Governor of the state of Minnesota, which was a huge honor to be asked. And after that, I wound up becoming art director for Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. It was there that I got introduced to public art and fell in love. And I started my own business called 5x5 Public Art Consultants. And I wound up working as the art consultant for the airport for a year after leaving the position of the art director. And wound up taking a job in California as a public art consultant. And unfortunately, COVID hit. So I relocated. I had a place here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And I say New Mexico because there is a Santa Fe, Argentina, and I don't want people to, yeah, I'm in Argentina. No, at Santa Fe, New Mexico. And I'm doing work with the city of Albuquerque on public art projects here, but also working on projects back in the Twin Cities. And one just happened, which was the Prince mural. But I'm also working on other public art projects that reflect what was happening in the community during the George Floyd uprising. We're doing a mural at Phelps Park, which is a block from where George Floyd was killed. And we're also restoring a 72,000 square foot building that was destroyed in the riots with artwork from artists in the Twin Cities and poetry. And there's going to be digital art and art from artists, BIPOC artists from across the country. So working on many different projects, I really love what I'm doing with public art because it goes back to what I was raised with. Having a father as a politician and a mother that was an activist. It's very important to me to always give back and always give people a voice. And that's what public art does. You know, when you see graffiti on a building, it's because people feel shut out and they don't have a voice. And I think since the riots, people have seen the strength of what street art and public art can do. You know, if you are a person that is an immigrant, a newly arrived immigrant, you don't speak the language, what you see in murals and words on walls can give you an idea of what's happening in your community. It gives you the opportunity to be a part of the planning and the development, the fabrication and the design of public art in your community, whether it's public art that helps the community in some way, environmentally, it protects you from shade in a very hot, sunny community, or it's a way of giving back to kids in the community and get them involved in things that's happening in their community. You're trying to do things that, what I call emotional equity, it's the buy-in that people feel that they're a part of. When you talk about your church, your school, your grocery store, your favorite bar, that's emotional equity. That's the buy-in. that you are part of the community and you care about that community. You feel an attachment to that community. So you want to see that community grow and thrive. That's what public art does by getting people in the community involved in the decision making of what art goes in the community that speaks to what they need. So that's why it's attractive to me. I could be a talking head forever and give stories about what's happening in the community, or I can take part in what's happening in the community. And I tried to do that a lot while I was on the air. I tried to do that by having an art gallery. I tried to do that with the Buzz. I tried to do that by working in urban affairs, covering gang summits, all that. But I feel a great deal more sense of reward because sadly, people don't really trust any messenger that comes to them that challenges the status quo. Even Guggenheim, who had the first press, was burned down because people don't always like the message. And granted, working for an organization that has its own message that they want to deliver because they own it, whether it's a Ted Turner or a General Electric, on their own agenda. And you become a mouthpiece for that agenda. You start to represent a multi-million dollar corporation that is not fully invested in the whole community. They're invested in those people that support the sponsors. And then the rest of us are Schadenfreude, which is basically, oh, look at those people. They're poor. They're criminals. Aren't we lucky that we don't live like that? And when you start realizing that, you want to do more to give back to the community. I want to create a legacy in the Twin City that lives past me so that people that I worked with can take their grandkids and say, I worked on that. Your grandpa did this. That's what's important to me. And so that's why 5x5 is what it is.
Yeah, this, before I let you go, there's a couple questions, but there's a statement that you were the first and only reporter I respected after moving to Minneapolis. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Rich. That makes me feel good. Somebody just recently did a story on Pat Miles, who was a huge talent in the Twin Cities. I really respected Pat. She was an amazing personality that you will never see like that again. There was, TV has changed so much. But it was more important to me to be more than just a new celebrity. I came to Minneapolis on a Greyhound bus with no job and no money. And because I could understand Midwestern sensibilities and learn how the people there were, how they interacted. Minnesota is a big city that's a very small town, as you know. And you also know that if your last name is Swinson, Olson, Nielsen, Robinson, you move through the community a lot faster. If you get in with a Minnesotan, they will introduce you to the community. The way you learn things in the Minnesota, everything is 1-2 degree separation. And if you do right by Minnesotans, they welcome you into their fold. I still say to this day, if you get invited to the cabin, child, you don't want to get invited to the cabin because you are really learning Minnesota in depth. The cabin is where all the secrets are. So, it's nice to be invited. It means that you're one of them. Go to the cabin. Never go to the cabin. You will see secrets you don't want to see, things you don't want to know.
For sure. Someone was asking a question about the mural. Do you know why the artist chose certain Prince eras? Before I even asked a deeper question, do you know anything about really why he chose what he chose or not really?
The images were provided by the family in Paisley Park.
Okay. Because someone was asking why they used a closed mouth image instead of an open mouth on it, but that probably be for someone else to be able to answer.
There was great discussion about what images, but it was the family's choice.
For sure. Robin, thank you so much for being on. Thank you so much for doing such an amazing job honoring and respecting the legacy of Prince at the celebration at Paisley Park this year. I loved having you on. I love your energy.
This was a great joy for me. I got a chance to tell things in depth that I hadn't been able to talk about before. The book is out there. I honestly am trying to write it. It's in the atmosphere. I got to get it down on paper because there's going to be a whole chapter just about Prince. And there are stories I couldn't tell today either, but you know, that's for another celebration.
For sure. And you're going to be, I think I saw that you're going to provide some of the raw footage of the interviews to Paisley Park or to the estate.
Yeah, I have them here. They're on VHS. I haven't gotten them dubbed over to CD or anything, but I have all that video and I want it to go to Paisley Park. I want them to use it. It's just raw footage. It's all raw footage and I'd love for them to have it.
For sure. And I'm sure there's going to be someone in this room that'll hit you up. That's going to be like, I'll help you transfer this stuff.
So, they already have, and I won't let it out of my possession because I'm afraid it'll disappear.
There you go. It has to be your eyes on it for sure.
Definitely.
Thank you again, Robin, so much for your precious time. I truly, truly appreciate it and appreciate you so much.
Thank you, everybody that wrote in. I wish I could. I can read all these later, right?
Yes, you can go back and they'll add more because sometimes when people, they can't watch this show live, but they'll add in more comments for sure.
Okay, this was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Please hit that Venmo. Hit that Venmo because we wouldn't have Prince's History if it wasn't for the doctor. Thank you so much. This was wonderful and I loved it. Thank you so much for letting me come and be a part of your show.
Of course, my pleasure. And I'm sure everyone else's pleasure as well. Till next time, Robin, definitely we'll be seeing you soon and being in touch.
All right, you guys. Peace.
Thank you so much. Thank you to Robin Robinson for her time. Thank you guys so much. Going to be doing a brief after show to let you know about some other things upcoming, of course, at the Record Store Day of the Gold Experience. Thank you guys for your donations. It's always appreciated. Again, thank you guys for watching on YouTube and subscribing on YouTube. Check us out on Facebook Live, Apple Music, Stitcher, and all the other places. I'm going to take a brief break, but we'll be back for the after show. Thank you guys so much. Keep it funky, and thank you, Prince.